CliffCentral.com.
All right. I mentioned earlier that there are a couple of very, very interesting stories that are starting to emerge, and sometimes it takes many years after something has happened for a story to come out. This is one of those. Ben was talking about, what was it, Monument Men? Is that the show that you used to talk about?
Yeah.
Right. So that was a movie about kind of stolen Nazi art, and I didn't know that here in South Africa we'd have some kind of link to that.
Oh.
Yeah. And it's amazing how, you know, this is how many years later now? 60, 70 years later almost. And there's a great book called Dagger Dust, which has just come out. And it's the story, really, of a guy called Connie Mattison who looked into his family's history, right?
Yeah, hi, Gareth.
How are you? Now, you're not Connie. You're Charles Slea. You're the co-author.
Yeah, I'm the young guy that wasn't around when all of this was kind of kicking off.
It's quite something.
And, you know, I heard about this guy, and he's 70 now.
Yeah.
And I met him when he was 65. And, you know, I was hanging out with some guys who were trying to make movies. You know, they were doing documentaries. I was working at FHM at the time.
Right.
And these guys said, you know, we found this guy and he's spent like 30, 40 years trying to recover this art that was stolen from his great uncle in Norway.
They were in Norway, yeah.
In 1941. So this guy was friends with some of the greatest painters of the time, you know, mostly impressionists. And it's people like Edgar Degas, Lautrec, Manet, and Matisse.
These are some incredibly valuable paintings. And these impressionists are probably the guys who fetch the biggest price tags at Sotheby's and Christie's.
Absolutely. I mean, if you take that first exhibition they had, I mean, when they were nobodies.
Toulouse-Lautre, this is some serious money.
It is. Of course, he doesn't like to really look at it in terms of money. For him,
I'm looking at it in terms of money.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But, you know, he didn't do it to make money out of it, because he hasn't sold a single one of these paintings, and he never will. And I doubt that his children will someday either.
Sure.
And they don't have documentation. I think that's the really fascinating thing about it, is that he never received a single certifying document for any of these paintings. But he did track down the Nazi that he believed is the guy that pulled the trigger in 1941.
All right, so let's go all the way back to the 1940s. Norway was invaded. It was right near the beginning. It was before
1940, yeah.
Before the French had succumbed, or yeah, it was. It was just before the French and Holland had gone down and all the rest of it. Norway was an important key point for Hitler.
Yeah, he needed it for Sweden's iron ore, and they were trying to build
Norwegian
an atomic
oil.
Bomb.
Right.
They were trying to build an atomic bomb, and Norway had heavy water.
Correct.
Which they needed.
Deuterium.
Indeed.
So, this guy's family, Carney's family, what kind of people were they? What were they doing? Were they very wealthy people? I mean, you'd imagine with all of this art.
So this great uncle of his was possibly the most mysterious member of their family,
yeah.
You know, because he was just kind of doing his own thing there. And a lot of the pogroms of the time had spread the family far and wide, which is the reason why Carney was born here in Joburg. And, you know, the book looks into all of that interesting diaspora mm-hmm. of the Jewish people in the late 1800s. And how they got to Pretoria, and how they became in many ways part of the early Afrikaners as mm-hmm. the Smos,
mm-hmm.
you know, and many of them still kept their Jewish identity, but a lot of the Yiddish went out. By the time Carney's dad was a theater man, you know, a lot of that brilliant Yiddish dramatism that he loved so much just wasn't finding an audience anymore.
Yeah.
So this family member was known and spoken of, and there were these notes and these letters, but people didn't really speak too openly about it because very traumatic.
Mm.
And so he had to kind of piece it together, and he spent so much of his life, and he looks back in it now and he thinks he wishes that his parents were alive, especially his father, because his father knew a lot more about what happened to his great uncle, whose name was Cornelissen.
Now, this great uncle Cornelissen, he was shot by the Nazis, right?
Yeah, he was shot in the head after being kicked out of his house down the stairs.
And this was the house where all these artworks were.
So yes, I mean, this guy was quite old at this time, and he had had this friendship with Edgar Degas early in his life before.
So he actually knew him?
No, he knew most of these. I mean, that's what makes many of these paintings so special, is that they were
personal gifts.
I mean, he was an international business lawyer. And it's very interesting how Carney kind of modeled his own life on his idea of who this great uncle was. Because Carney became a lawyer much the same. You know, he also does international business law, mercantile law, and he has a PhD now in law, and he's a high court lawyer.
And he's a pilot. And
he's,
he's
an aviator. He can fly helicopters.
Right.
And he started Supper Theatre in South Africa. He's
fantastic.
He's a big entrepreneur. He owns businesses here in South Africa and elsewhere in America and so on. So,
an interesting family.
It's a very interesting family in many ways. I would say a dysfunctional family, and a lot of that comes from his childhood, where his parents were very troubled, and none of that is held back in the book. You know, and his, I would say his mother was quite abusive towards him, and that made him the person that he is, because he just decided at a very young age that, you know what, I'm just going to look after myself. And he bought himself a tiny little boxed caravan.
Right.
And he had a little power lead from the house to the caravan. And he froze his butt off in winter and just taught himself how to play the violin. And he was in a philharmonic orchestra in his teens already. And, you know, went up to this cave up there in Astfelkop, because they lived what is now Northcliffe, was more or less peri-urban farmland plots back in those days for poor people. Now it's like the abode of CEOs and captains of industry.
There's huge houses up there.
Absolutely. You know, the best views in Joburg. But back then, it was more or less just the land of the vultures, you know, and he would go up there and hang out with the vultures and play his violin in this cave. And it was there where he kind of decided that, you know what, I can do whatever I want. Because he looked down and he saw these tiny little cars moving at night along this little road. And he said, you know, all of those people have tiny problems. And he said he felt a bit like Gulliver looking down at the Lilliputians. And it was this transcendent moment for him in his life where he said, you know what, I'm never going to let any problem be bigger than me. And ultimately, I'm actually insignificant. So it doesn't really matter what I do. I should just do what I feel like doing, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody. So for him to take on a task like this to try to find these paintings, I mean, people said to him, you know what, that's kind of impossible, man. I mean,
they'll never win.
Where are you going to do
that? You're never going to get anything back. It's going to be a waste of money and time. And
he agreed with him. He said, yeah, sure, I know it's impossible. But whenever the opportunity came along, you know, he would try. And, you know, he wrote to almost every art dealer that he could in Europe. He went to, I mean, I think the families that he made contact with here in Joburg, a lot of it was driven by this quest for the art. And I think that's what contributed to him becoming successful, because he started moving in these circles of people who were into art. And that kind of shaped him into the person he is now, because, you know, he was meeting some of the richest people in South Africa. You know, he became this bank manager, and back in those days, being a bank manager made you somebody very special.
Mm.
Nowadays, it's nothing much. You know, back then you could really make big decisions, and people could make that call to their bank manager, and that was a big deal.
Right.
Nowadays, nobody says that anymore. Nobody says, hey, I'm going to phone my bank manager. Like,
no. What?
But back then, you know, that's the kind of world that he was inhabiting, and it opened up opportunities for him. And so, you know, when he just did all these crazy things, like suddenly I'm a lawyer, but I'm going to go off and learn to be a helicopter pilot. I'm going to go and fly with the SA Air Force at Drakensberg, Dragon Peaks Air Force Base, and learn to be this super like airwolf pilot.
Yeah.
You know, and he was able to do these hectic maneuvers down the side of mountains and in gusting winds. And, you know, he was approached by the government and they said, you know what, we need to bust sanctions because, you know, the world hates us.
Right.
And he was saying, well, you know, I'm a Jewish guy. I mean, I hate apartheid.
Yeah.
And then they said, yeah, but you're going to work with Mossad. And he said, okay, I'm in, because they can maybe help me to find these paintings. So he had all these adventures.
Oh, brilliant.
You know, he had all these adventures that he wouldn't have had if he hadn't said, I want to find those paintings. And so because he started working with Mossad, and he more or less became a kind of part-time spy while being a lawyer and all these other things, and flying people across the border and flying goods and things across the border to bust sanctions, that's how they helped him ultimately. It took years and years and years. But they put him in touch with someone.
It's a treasure hunt.
It's a treasure hunt.
But I mean, the story of this family and everything else, notwithstanding the treasure hunt, would have been fascinating enough. So it gives you an excuse to tell these amazing stories.
Indeed.
And Connie must have been an incredible person to work with on this book, because you must have discovered new things every time you spoke to him.
Well, it was extraordinary. I mean, I just originally wanted a story for my magazine that I was working for. And we got a nice lead story, 6 pages, you know, and I thought my work here is done. But what I based that on was a self-published book that he had done. And reading that, there were so many unanswered questions.
Yeah.
You know, and I said to him, Connie, you know, you've got an amazing story, but what's really going on here? You haven't really told it in the right order, and there's a lot of intrigue, but I don't really understand who you are and what the motivation was. So I told him, you know what, if I can find a South African publisher for you, then let's tell your story again. Let's write the book from scratch again. And he agreed to do that. But he's not somebody that really likes the attention. You know, he wrote that original book more for his children, mm-hmm. so that they would kind of have an idea of who he was, because they always used to say to him, you know, Dad, you're kind of a weirdo. Like, what, how did you do all these things, and what are you about? So he wrote that book. So I had to kind of twist his arm and say, you know what, Connie, come on. You know, South Africa deserves to hear the story, because we didn't even know that we had a kind of Nazi hunter.
So how did the treasure hunt go? I mean, where did he start hitting pay dirt in terms of finding out about the actual events of his great uncle's death? What happened to his possessions? When did he make a breakthrough?
So I think he first came to a full consciousness of it when he was about 10 years old. But, you know, up to as much as you can understand when you're 10.
Mm.
You know, and it's quite a dramatic scene where, you know, he asks his dad in the kitchen in their little humble home there with the linoleum floors. And
yeah, he said the wrong side of the tracks and everything.
Kind of the wrong side of the tracks, and, you know, and the water's, and it's raining, and the water's dripping into a bucket there from the leaky ceiling. And his dad sitting there with a coffee and reading a book. His dad was a voracious reader. And he says to him, you know what, Dad, please just tell me what's up with these letters. And he says, I can't speak of those things. And, you know, he found scraps of papers in drawers talking about this Toulouse-Lautrec that he eventually was able to track down, which is a fascinating painting in its own right, because it's more complete. It looks more complete than the version that's hanging in Paris, because the version in Paris doesn't have the woman's head, and it doesn't have a piece of that double bass. So what was said to him, and from what he gathered from the fragments of documentation that he read, was that that was actually the original, and it was stolen from a bar, some kind of dive bar in Paris, because, you know, these things weren't worth much back in those days. And it was just poster art, you know, and nobody realized it's going to turn into this kind of icon of modern culture. So for him to have received that back, you know, it just arrived. It didn't arrive with all the other paintings that he received.
How did it just arrive? I don't understand.
It was just dropped at his door. You know, I mean, all
here
the,
in Johannesburg.
Yeah, I mean, all the other paintings there's quite a.
I mean, who gets a Toulouse-Lautrec dropped off at their door?
People who've done big favors for Mossad.
That's phenomenal.
It is an interesting story, and so I think we didn't get too caught up in whether or not these things are real. I mean, Carney's completely open to the possibility that they're all forgeries and that he's been led up the garden path.
Mm.
But the story is what it is.
I mean, the Gauguin looks amazing.
These paintings are lovely, yeah.
It looks like all his other work.
And, I mean, you can kind of, I've looked at all these paintings, and you can kind of lose yourself in them because they look so old. You know, they've got all the telltale signs of things that have been around for a really long time, and that they've seen a lot of movement.
And does he just hang them up in his house?
He's got them. He's got some hanging up in the US. He's got some in Cape Town. He's got some up here. So
it's amazing.
It's quite extraordinary. He's got an original forgery by the Nazi himself, where the Nazi said to him, you know what, I'm an artist too. That's why I've looked after these paintings for such a long time.
Did he have much conversation with this guy, this Nazi?
They met three times. So
how did this Nazi just manage to elude the authorities, or how did it happen?
So they found him through his attempt to sell one of these paintings. And it was just the exact wrong painting to try to sell, because it's the painting that gave him away. You know, and I mean, if you read the book, it explains exactly how they knew. Because looking at it and looking at Carney, you know, like, wow, this is it. So that gave him away. And, you know, he was pretending to be, you know, ironically enough, Jewish, calling himself Herr Mandelbaum.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he was able to pass off his German accent for being a Swiss citizen. And obviously, you can't really elude Mossad forever. If they start looking for you in their sites, they're going to find you. And there's a lot in the book that looks into how these guys were actually helped to escape during and after the war, primarily through the Vatican, through being given papers by the Catholic Church to escape to
Chile,
places
Argentina,
like Argentina,
Namibia,
where they were warmly welcomed. And you know, these are things that were all documented very well, because one thing that the Germans.
The Germans
at the time,
were meticulous about their records.
I mean, even everybody they gassed and shot and so on in the Holocaust, they had records of. I mean, they contracted IBM to monitor these people, and those barcodes that you see on people's arms and necks, those are IBM codes.
So, they were the first Google.
It's insane. And so, you know, because they were so OCD, you can track these people down, and that's pretty much what happened in this case. But if this guy hadn't popped out of the woodwork trying to sell this painting, then I don't think any.
So did he go to jail?
So he had a lot of intelligence information that was of interest to Mossad, mm-hmm. and also to, oddly enough, the KGB, which kind of comes out in the book as well. Talking about Project Paperclip, which was that American kind of, you could almost call it a scam, of kind of cleaning, expunging the records of some of the worst Nazis.
So that they could use them for their science.
So that they could use them for science.
At Los Alamos.
So because this guy had a lot of original documentation on that, I Carney believes that he traded on that.
He made a deal.
To kind of, you know, just basically
is
say...
Is he the guy who killed his great uncle?
We don't know that for a fact, but the fact is the guy did admit to having been in that house.
Wow.
He did have the artwork. But whether or not he pulled the trigger, who can say? He never, you know, he never said that. All he told Carney was, you know, I followed my orders. And of course, that there's a line in the book that says, so much of the worst of human history has been covered by those words. I just followed orders.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very reflective book. And
I think
for a South African audience, it's something that, you know, the publishers asked me, well, you know, who would want to read this? And I was like, well, who wouldn't? You know?
Well, there's a bit of history of Johannesburg in there. There's a bit of history of kind of the stage door, which was the place that he started. The art itself is almost that's the treasure at the end of the story. The adventure is finding it.
Yeah, and I think the fact that he's a maverick and the fact that I find him an inspirational guy. I mean, I don't really like motivational books per se. You know, I'm not going to go out there and buy the Yes, You Can.
No.
But to read a book like this has got that built into it to say, you know what, you can do crazy, amazing things if you really want to. You know, if you have the energy for it and you have the personality and the audacity.
Why doesn't he have someone appraise these and figure out if they're forgeries or not?
Look, he has.
And?
It's just very difficult without the paperwork. And, you know, he believes that the paperwork was withheld, you know, and or perhaps...
This Nazi's dead now.
Yes, he died. Carney feels like he found out in a very strange way. Very, very strange way.
It's all so mysterious, right?
But he heard that the old guy died at a bus stop in the cold in Portugal on his own.
Wow. And he left nothing, no further instructions or information.
So it's if you read the book, there's a lot of things that I don't want to give away, but a lot revolves around what happened with this Nazi son.
Oh.
You know, and Carney plays a role later without unwittingly, you know, in actually helping the son to get into South Africa to perhaps start a new life here. We don't really know what the heck that was all about. But it's one of the strangest moments in the book.
So it even has questions about whether or not you would help your enemy's children, that sort of thing.
Well, it does ask
covering
that,
a lot of...
It does ask that question of, you know, if your father did despicable things, you know, does that reflect on you? And of course, Carney thinks it shouldn't. You know, so he's got nothing against the guy's son. Because you can't let the sins of the father pass on.
Quite a story. I mean, you must have had a lot of fun writing this.
You know, there's a lot of fun moments. A lot of it is just bum in seat, a lot of frustration trying to find out, you know, what's what, and trying to get the feeling of the
story.
He
didn't hold anything back from you, did he?
No. I think at first, you know, when you start writing a book with someone, I think the first thing you always try to do is establish trust and get that person to understand that you just want to tell the story right.
Yeah.
And that they can trust you. And the moment that you get that done, and it's been an experience of note. I mean, 5 years later, you know, he and I are very close friends, and he's an enormously generous guy. And I think it would have been great to chat to him too.
Yeah. We'll tell him to come in there one day.
You know, he's in Cape Town, but...
Next time he's up here, I'd love to talk to him.
Okay.
Sounds fascinating. So there it is. Nazi war booty, Degas dust. Carney Madison and Charles Salia. We're talking to Charles now about the book. It's fascinating. I love the fact that this is a real life story, but it almost feels like you're reading a novel.
I think, you know, he wanted to make a movie.
Yeah.
And he was talking to some big South African producers, I think maybe the odd person in America as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying to him that they do see a movie in it. They're just not sure which aspect of the story is the movie. But I see it as a bit of an Art Nouveau film. You know, you could perhaps try to turn it into an action kind of James Bondy type of thing, but that would be distorting what really happened there. You know, it's a very deep story about one man and some very, very strange things that happened to him. And that's why he wrote the original book as well, just for people to have that idea of the story. And so part of this book is now, you know, these people are going to read it now and decide, now we've got the whole story, and if we are going to do a screenplay, we've more or less got...
You could end up being the screenplay guy for a big Hollywood movie, Charles. This is very exciting. All right, well, listen, thank you for telling us this morning. It's a terrific book. Go and have a look at it. It's called Degas Dust, and it's available now, right?
Yeah, it's as far as I know, it's in all the good bookshops. It's about 280 Rand.
What you're basically saying is if it's not in that bookshop, it's not a good bookshop.
It's a pretty crap bookshop.
There we go. Now, that's how we sell these things. I'm with you. But well done. Terrific, terrific stuff. When we come back in a moment, we're going to do a little bit of conspiracy theory with Flax, and then we've got to wrap it up for this morning. A very busy day on cliffcentral.com for the rest of it. Stick around. But a big thank you to Charles Salia for coming in to talk to us about this.
Thanks for having me.
And well done on the book. Cliffcentral.com.